obligated to, you know, to pay these.
Hi, my name is Kurt. I have a comment about the scheduling on Sunday afternoon. The Present Edge, which is runs from, I think, 1 to 3 or whatever, I think that show is consistently very weak. I just can't imagine anybody tuning in to KJNU for the first time and wanting to listen to that show. You have a couple of shows that you took off the air that were pretty strong, Sound and Spirit and Afro Pop. And I think those would be much better shows to have on Sunday afternoon. People tuning around, and especially in Denver, never heard KJNU. That would attract people to the station, and those were good shows. Also, I think it would be great to have E-Town, a second airing during the week of E-Town, maybe in the evening instead of one of the jazz hours in the late night. It's such a powerful, feel-good show. I think two airings of it would be great. Thanks. Bye.
Good morning. I'm calling this morning about the elephant in the newsroom. Now, I'm not talking about the controlled demolition of the three buildings at the World Trade Center. No, I'm talking about House Bill 4437. This is the vicious anti-immigration bill that Representative Sensenbrenner from Wisconsin has foisted, along with the rest of the majority of the House of Representatives, has foisted this piece of garbage on the American people. And yes, it is true. Marilyn Musgrave, Tom Tancredo, as well as Mark Udall, have voted for this bill in the House of Representatives.
Thanks for those calls to the comment line. You can call anytime, 303-447-9911. We play the comments back over the air here on the Tuesday Morning Magazine, where it's 8:30, time for news from the BBC.
Not to take direct military action against the Palestinian government. Instead, it's decided to revoke the residency of Hamas members who live in Jerusalem. President Bush has said that all options are on the table to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons. Speaking at the White House, Mr. Bush said the United States was still trying to resolve the issue diplomatically. Earlier, the Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, warned that Iran would, as he put it, cut off the hand of any aggressor. The environmental charity Greenpeace says recent studies have shown that many more people are likely to die as a result of the 1986 Chernobyl nuclear disaster than the United Nations has predicted. The most recent figures issued by the United Nations suggest that 9,000 people will die in the three countries affected by the disaster, Ukraine, Russia and Belarus. However, Greenpeace says new studies suggest about 100,000 additional deaths will occur from cancer and other illnesses in the worst affected countries. Oil prices have reached a new high, topping $72 a barrel on markets in London and New York, amid fears about supplies from Iran, the world's fourth largest oil producer. A new ruling has come into effect in Malawi, which prevents unauthorized traders from selling their wares on city streets. Police and soldiers have been patrolling the main towns to enforce the ban. On Monday, there were clashes in the commercial capital Blantyre after police fired tear gas to disperse vendors holding public prayers as part of protests against the order. And the American city of San Francisco is commemorating the 100th anniversary of an enormous earthquake. BBC World News.
8:32 at KGNU. A reminder that coverage of the state legislature is made possible in part by the Gay and Lesbian Fund for Colorado on the web at gayandlesbianfund.org and by Pro Audio Websites, audio distribution sites for music and content professionals, proaudiowebsites.com. Breezy today with highs around 50 degrees, mostly cloudy overnight, continued breezy and warmer tomorrow, with forecast highs on Wednesday in the upper 50s. Stay tuned for Jim Hightower and then How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show.
Here's a modest suggestion for dealing with illegal immigration. Instead of everyone looking down at all those impoverished Mexicans coming here for jobs, why not start looking up, focusing on the posh executive suites of corporate America, which has saddled both U.S. and Mexican working families with corporate written trade and labor policies that knock us all down. Let's start with NAFTA. Remember that Bill Clinton, the GOP, and all the corporate lobbyists promised that this trade deal would bring prosperity to Mexican laborers, thus stopping the flow of illegal workers into the USA. Well, 12 years later, real wages in Mexico are lower than before NAFTA was imposed. 19 million more Mexicans have fallen into poverty, and about half of Mexico's people are struggling to live on less than $5 a day. This NAFTA economy of a few fabulously rich families and an impoverished working class was deliberately created by a cabal of arrogance between CEOs in our country, the ruling elites in Mexico, and the political puppets of both. Now, here they come again, fostering xenophobia, proposing an absurd and shameful wall along our shared border, and encouraging a new Bracero program to turn low-wage Mexicans into a permanent flow of indentured workers for U.S. businesses. Meanwhile, these same corporations and their political puppets have been busting wages here at home, offshoring middle-class jobs, canceling pensions and health care plans, waging war against labor unions, and shredding our social contract. This is Jim Hightower saying, to deal effectively with illegal immigration, we must renegotiate these corporate trade scams and restore our labor laws so they actually help the workaday majority of people, raising middle-class possibilities here and in Mexico. This problem is not being caused by powerless people, but by the most powerful. It's time to look up and look the power elites right in their eye. Support for this program comes from The Progressive Magazine, featuring columnists Miley Ivins, Howard Zinn, and Barbara Ehrenreich, with features and information available at progressive.org.
I'm Kate Becker.
And I'm Judy Lubow. This is How on Earth for April 18th, 2006.
Coming up, the science behind evolution and intelligent design.
We begin with a look at some of the recent news in science.
Overusing antibiotics can have a dangerous unintended consequence, new bacterial strains that are resistant to common antibacterial medicines. Now, scientists in Australia have found that by restricting the use of antibiotics in food animals, like poultry, they can also reduce the number of resistant bacteria affecting humans. Australia has one of the world's most restrictive policies regarding the use of antibiotics on food animals. Fluoroquinolones, a class of broad-spectrum antibiotics used regularly in other industrialized nations, are prohibited for food animal use. This makes the country a unique laboratory to study how antibiotics used on animals end up affecting the rest of the food chain. Australian researchers isolated a particular foodborne bacteria in 600 patients. About 2% of the infections were resistant to a fluoroquinolone antibiotic. In countries that use such antibiotics on their animals, nearly 30% of human infections are expected to be drug-resistant. The results will be published next month in the journal Clinical Infectious Diseases. The study's authors point out that the use of antibiotics in food animals is just one of many factors contributing to the rise of drug-resistant bacteria. The United States banned fluoroquinolones in poultry in 2005.
Researchers from the University of Pittsburgh Medical School and Carnegie Mellon have created chemical dyes that can show voltage changes of cardiac cells, including those deep within the heart, where contractions of the heart are initiated. The dyes should enable medical researchers to better understand the causes of heart arrhythmias, or irregular heartbeat, and sudden cardiac arrest. The researchers have described 7 of the so-called Pittsburgh dyes in the current issue of the Journal of Membrane Biology. The dyes emit fluorescent light in response to changes in voltage that occur across cell membranes. The dyes enable researchers to map in real time the voltage changes of cardiac cells below the surface of the heart. They can also be used simultaneously with other dyes to provide a more complete and accurate picture of the processes influencing normal and abnormal heart rhythms. The more sophisticated knowledge gained through these dyes should enable researchers to better understand why and how irregular heartbeats and sudden cardiac arrest occur.
Evolution, creationism, intelligent design, what are the actual scientific differences between these theories, and what is the debate about them, about their use in a scientific classroom, really about? How on Earth's Judy Lubow talked to Professor Jamie Nagel of the Physics Department of the University of Colorado after Professor Nagel gave a lecture at CU about the evolution, intelligent design debate. Here is what Professor Nagel has to say about the science behind this public debate.
You gave a lecture today that was entitled Evolution, Creationism, Intelligent Design, and Physics. Could you please summarize for our audience what the words evolution, creationism, and intelligent design mean?
Well, evolution typically refers in the field of biology to the idea that all living things have a common ancestor, and sometimes this is referred to as descent with modification. And it started in some ways with Charles Darwin, but has developed into a much broader theory by a lot of scientists. The idea of intelligent design is a non-scientific idea that attributes sort of supernatural forces or things beyond nature, typically a deity, that intervenes, breaking the physical laws to then change the course of history, either in biological evolution or any other area of science. People have often made the distinction with creationism as referring to essentially a specific interpretation of a religious text, often the Bible. Many of the promoters of intelligent design, it's really only very marginally different from creationism itself.
And you mentioned in the talk that intelligent design seemed to evolve, no pun intended, from the concept of creationism after a court suit. Could you talk a bit about that?
Right. I mean, intelligent design is a very old idea, dating back to people like Paley, who talked about, whether there were things in nature that were sort of so remarkable that they could not have evolved. But what people often refer to as the modern intelligent design movement, particularly in the United States of America, often dates to the 1987 Supreme Court decision, where they basically ruled that creation science was not science, it was really a religious belief system, and that it was unconstitutional. It was against the Establishment Clause to teach that in public schools. And so one of the things that happened was people who felt that that teaching was very important often then changed the word creationism in their texts and in their speeches to intelligent design. It was sort of reformulated and repackaged. Some of that repackaging is some sophistication to it, and some of it was as simple in one of the books that I referred to of Pandas and People, where it really looked essentially like a word replace creationism for intelligent design, leaving all of the definitions the same as they were before.
What does physics, which is your specialty, have to do with the debate about evolution?
I think the common thread is science. In some ways, physics as a discipline is maybe the most embedded in the scientific method. The issue of how we teach people, not just in the public schools, but in general, how we discuss things as science is of critical importance to me. And so one of the reasons that I was very interested in this issue, not just in giving a talk, but in really researching it for myself, is that a lot of the things that they're proposing to tell people, particularly students in public schools, but also in other venues, about science really is not correct. It's not just a matter of defending somehow the science of evolution or of biologists. It's really trying to improve the science understanding as a whole, which is something that's really been highlighted as suffering in this country.
You just talked about science, and I know in your lecture you talked an awful lot about the scientific method. Could you please describe for our listeners what are the major components of the scientific method?
There are many different aspects, but the key thing is that people make hypotheses that are falsifiable, means that they're testable in a way that could show the hypothesis to be not true. It's then characterized by doing experiments to test those hypotheses. Another key thing is that when you get results, you then publish them in peer-reviewed journals. And that means that other people, your colleagues, are able to look at your results critically and offer criticism, and that you take that criticism as feedback. And then people need to be able to repeat those experiments. If you get a certain result and you publish them, the first thing people want to do is to reproduce those results, because the laws of physics should be universal. The one other thing, which is often difficult for people to do, but is a critical part of the scientific method, is the willingness to accept falsification of your theory, to change your theory in light of new evidence. Science tells us that we should remain open-minded.
Would you define creationism and intelligent design as a scientific theory or as a religious belief?
Well, I think certainly creationism is a religious belief. I think there's no real debate about that. If you have a particular direct interpretation of the Bible, for example, or another religious text, it's clearly a religious belief. Doesn't mean that it's wrong. It just means it's not scientifically based. It's religiously based. Intelligent design has tried to sort of mask itself with scientific language so that it looks more like a scientific theory. But in reality, it really is not. It fails to really display any of the hallmark characteristics of the scientific method that I outlined in your previous question. And so it really fails that criteria on all accounts. And that was a part of the court decision in Dover, Pennsylvania, was that it really was not science. It really was a religious belief.
I did want to ask you about the Dover, Pennsylvania school board decision, because that was a major part of your lecture. Could you talk about that?
When I was originally researching for the lecture, it was in the middle of the court case, so the decision actually hadn't been made. But when the decision was made, a couple months before this talk, you know, I read through the 139-page decision, and I was really fascinated by how strongly the judge came out against intelligent design. Judge Jones, who presided, is a Bush appointee to the federal court just a few years ago, and so he's really not a liberal judicial activist in that any sense of the word. Not only did he find in great detail in the decision that the proposal of teaching intelligent design and recommending this particular book of pandas and people as an intelligent design textbook that the students might read, not only did he find that it was a religious belief and so it violated the Establishment Clause of the Constitution to teach it in a public school, he went far beyond that, and he specifically addressed the issue of whether it had any scientific merit, whether it qualified as being science. And his decision was extremely strong against intelligent design as being science. The Dover policy was that a statement would be read to the ninth grade biology students in a public school, but it essentially argued that the state of Pennsylvania required them to teach evolution to the students, and that the school board recognized that evolution is just a theory. It's not a fact. There are gaps in the theory. And so students should consider an alternative theory, that of intelligent design. And it recommended the reading of the book of Pandas and People to those students. And then they provided those books to the school library.
Did the decision basically say that evolution is a theory and intelligent design is not a theory? What did the decision really say?
Judge Jones in the decision clearly says that evolution is a scientific theory, and in fact he makes pretty strong statements that it's a well-backed scientific theory. Now, of course, he's not a scientist, but he listened to testimony from many different scientists, both on the side of intelligent design and from the National Academy of Sciences and other scientists. He also then found that intelligent design is not a scientific theory, and that it fails at many different levels from being qualified as being science. One of the strongest statements that he made is that he says that at best the intelligent design movement is somewhat disingenuous. And I want to be very careful here. That's not to say people who believe in an intelligent designer or have religious faith. That's perfectly fine. It's the people from particularly the Discovery Institute who are really promoting this as a scientific theory and then trying to directly plug that in to high school students, they're really not being very upfront. They're sort of hiding some of the facts in the way that they describe things because their case is very weak. And that was one of the very strong findings of the judge in the case.
We've been listening to Professor Jamie Nagel of CU discuss the public and legal debate behind teaching intelligent design in the classroom. Professor Nagel continues by discussing the differences between the two theories from a scientific point of view and whether there is an inherent conflict between religion and the theory of evolution.
Is part of the concern with intelligent design being a scientific theory that there has not actually been scientific research done in support of it?
That's certainly part of it. Now, of course, if you have a theory that is not falsifiable or testable, it's unclear exactly what scientific research you would do. But since the proponents of intelligent design argue it is a scientific theory, then they should be able to do tests and research on it. And one of the striking things that I found was that the Templeton Foundation, which supports sort of the interchange of science and religion, they had a number of grants to people trying to understand intelligent design, to go to conferences and to give talks. But when they put out a proposal, offered money for grants to actually do research, you know, perhaps set up a laboratory and actually do some experiment, they found that actually there were almost no takers. Almost none of the intelligent design community were actually interested in doing any real research. And they were, the people at this foundation, which has a religious base, were really quite surprised by that. They viewed that very negatively.
Why do you feel that this whole debate about teaching intelligent design as science as opposed to the theory of evolution is going on right now? What do you think is really behind this?
Well, I think to a large extent, it's not so much that it's just now. It's really been a continuing debate and discussion and controversial point in the public sphere for over a century, really. It's not a controversy in the scientific sphere, but in the public sphere, it particularly is. I think the reason it's maybe highlighted more recently is there have been some supportive statements from the President of the United States, George Bush. There have also been some supportive statements from some other leading politicians, Tom DeLay, Bill Frist. And so that has emboldened, in some sense, people who are trying to promote the teaching of intelligent design in the public schools to push it forward and to see whether they can sort of win in a climate where maybe there's a little bit more political support. Of course, it's a funny issue to scientists. The President of the United States doesn't decide what is science and what is not. In fact, he may not be particularly qualified. Now, maybe that many of our presidents aren't particularly qualified in that scientific realm, but they have a lot of weight. Now, in fact, the National Academy of Sciences has come out and said they really disagree with the President's statement, for example. And so in the press, this plays out as a very controversial issue in this big debate, and people feel very strongly. It's very hard to discuss things in a sort of logical, scientific sense when it involves people's faith. And so the debate often becomes very emotional. But that's something in science we try and not have. We try and view things what we call scientifically or objectively. The questions of what's right and wrong is not really part of science.
What was your intent in doing this lecture and in doing this research? What were you trying to do?
Well, I think a couple of things. The first thing was to educate myself. I became fascinated by the issue. And there's a professor at Case Western Reserve, Lawrence Krauss, who I am a big admirer of. He's a foremost physicist in the world. He's really worried about the direction of science education in the country, what we're teaching our kids, how we're going to advance as a society, what science's role is in our community. And I see that he and other people are becoming active as scientists, not just sitting in sort of an ivory tower quietly on the side. And so I thought this was an opportunity to educate myself and then maybe also talk to people about what I found, what those issues are. Maybe get them to think about these issues also in a scientific way actually, only a couple days before I gave this lecture, I read this article from earlier by Eric Cornell, who's a Nobel Prize-winning physicist in the department. And it said there's a call to action for scientists to engage in this discussion, to define and make clear what is science, how does science contribute to society. Not to say that science defines what is morally right and wrong. He says we should not do that. But we should really engage in this debate.
What was the most surprising thing that you discovered as you did this research for your lecture?
To be honest, I guess it would be two things. One is the almost complete lack of scientific research done by intelligent design. Given even just all of the information in the popular press, one might be under the impression that a fair amount of work has actually been done and that it has some sophistication, but that scientists disagree with it. But in fact, in reading through a large number of these books, a lot of the prose is sort of rambling, and they'll talk about certain examples, but it really, again, doesn't have any of the hallmarks of science, sort of logically consistent thinking and checking and testing of things. And so I was somewhat surprised by that. I think the other thing which maybe worried me the most in giving the talk is the uneasiness with which I found many people on this issue. And one of the things that's tough is you can believe that there is an intelligent designer. You can believe in God out of faith and not believe that there is a scientific theory called intelligent design that proves the existence of God. But people often don't quite see it that way. And so they see if you're discussing evolution and maybe picking apart the arguments of intelligent design, that maybe somehow you're leading to the conclusion that there is no intelligent designer or there is no God. But that really isn't at all true. But there's clearly uneasiness about that.
So would you say that the theory of evolution is neutral on whether there is an intelligent designer of the universe?
The theory of evolution as a scientific theory says absolutely nothing about whether God exists. It can't, by definition of it being a scientific theory. And so there is no inherent conflict between science and religious faith. And in fact, in the talk, I mentioned that the Vatican newspaper came out and said they supported the Dover decision, that intelligent design should not be taught as a scientific theory, that that's not correct. And there were over 10,000 ministers signed a statement saying that the attempts to teach intelligent design and denigrate the theory of evolution was not correct. And so clearly there's not a uniform conflict between religious faith and science.
All right, Dr. Nagel, thank you very much for giving us your time.
Oh, thank you for your time. It's been a pleasure.
We've just heard an interview by How on Earth's Judy Lubow with Professor Jamie Nagel of CU about the science behind the debate over the theories of creationism and intelligent design and the theory of evolution.
That's all for this edition of How on Earth. Our show was produced with help from Ewan Calloway. Sources for this week's news included eurekaalert.org. Tim Morton wrote our theme music. Tom Wassinger produced it.
Questions or comments? Call the KGNU comment line at 303-447-9911. For How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show, I'm Kate Becker.
And I'm Judy Lubow.
That was How on Earth, the Sounds of Science, KGNU's science show. Coming up in a couple of minutes, it's Alan Watts. But first, this announcement. This evening on Hemispheres, the International Press Review, tonight's program will take an in-depth look into Iran's attempt at enriching nuclear fuel. Also, a look at the Italian elections and the recent French demonstrations. Finally, a look at how the U.S. is pressuring Japan to accept beef that may be contaminated with mad cow disease. Calls will be accepted. That's tonight on Hemispheres. 858 on KGNU, 88.5 FM in Boulder, 1390 AM in Denver, and you can listen to us on the web at www.kgnu.org. Coming up, the wisdom and wit of Alan Watts. But first this.
KGNU would like to thank Namaste Solar Electric for their in-kind support. Namaste Solar Electric is locally owned and offers sustainable solar electricity for your home or business. They can be reached by phone at 303-447-0300 or online at namastesolar.com.
Welcome to another talk from the Alan Watts Radio Series number 4, Philosophy and Society. Philosopher, author, lecturer, and entertainer, Alan Watts has earned a reputation as one of the most unrutted philosophers of the 20th century. In this talk, Alan Watts discusses how science and mystical experience reveal the ever-growing resemblance between man and the world, as described by the physical sciences and the classical Eastern philosophies. From a session of the Nature of Consciousness seminar recorded on board the ferryboat the Vallejo in Sausalito, California, in 1967, it's part one of What is Reality? Here's Alan Watts.
I find it a little difficult to say what the subject matter of this seminar is going to be because it's too fundamental to give it a title. I'm going to talk about what there is. Now, the first thing, though, that we have to do is to get our perspectives with some background about the basic ideas which, as Westerners living today in the United States, influence our everyday common sense, our fundamental notions about what life is about. And there are